Good morning. A few weeks ago, Bob Huntley explained to us that his contentiousness, divisiveness, growliness, and talking about oligarchy was his way of being spiritual. And I appreciate him saying that because I think spirituality manifests itself in all kinds of different ways, in social action, in justice, doing service. Today, we get the touchy-feely version. Last spring, listening to Elizabeth's sermon on passion, I got to thinking about passion in my own life, and that led me to examine the passion that I feel for my work as a psychotherapist. I am crazy for therapy. I think that the world would be better off if instead of mandating military service, we would mandate a few years of therapy for everyone. For me, it's in my work that I feel most alive, inspired, and purposeful. And it's in my work that I have learned deeper and more experiential meaning of concepts that I heard talked about in church all my life. James Baldwin once said, referring to traveling in abroad, he said, "I met a lot of people in Europe. I even encountered myself. I have met a lot of people in the therapy room, and I have constantly encountered myself." Spirituality was at work in the process, even as I found spirituality at my work. Scott Peck, the author of The Road Less Traveled, explains that the experience of spiritual power is basically a joyful one, but it's a path of lifelong learning that comes slowly. That certainly is my story. I grew up in a traditional Christian church, Methodist, and though my mother was deep into her own conservative beliefs, fortunately she wasn't very preachy around the house. She never reinforced her discipline by calling upon God or Jesus, and as long as we didn't smoke, drink, cuss, or get pregnant, we were okay. I was a good girl, obedient, I wasn't troublesome, and I was a religious girl with a strong personal moral code. When I set the table and I dropped a fork on the floor, I always picked that fork up and put it at my place, and I was always very careful not to mention my good deed to anyone out loud. But I wasn't a very deep thinker. When I got to the College of Idaho and took the required religion classes, the more liberal theology that I heard there didn't cause a crisis of faith, which it actually did for some of my fellow students. What I heard there just seemed like it made sense to me. Apparently, I hadn't taken the conservative dogma very seriously in the first place. In young adulthood, I lived a happily unconscious, fruit-juicy life as a wife and mother. That's what Sherry Dowlin and I used to call it when we were raising our families backyard to backyard. There was a popular ad on TV then for Hawaiian Punch, where a little Hawaiian guy, a little cartoon guy, comes bouncing along the bottom of the screen. He's humming happily to himself, fruit juicy, fruit juicy, fruit juicy. And then all of a sudden, from nowhere, something comes along and wham, knocks him off his feet with a nice Hawaiian punch. Without pause, he picks himself up and resumes gaily humming, fruit juicy, singing his way off screen. Well, that was me in those days. Happily humming my way through the vagaries of family rearing without dipping too deeply into my inner life or actually even being aware that I might have an inner life. While the rest of America was waking up to the atrocities of Vietnam, to segregation, to the oppression of women, I was comfortably asleep in Idaho and in ignorance. But in my late 20s, I began to feel an itch for something more. Something was missing. And along with many in those days in the 70s, I began exploring Eastern thought. I learned and practiced transcendental meditation, read about metaphysical and paranormal experience, participated in the growth and consciousness raising of the human potential movement. I began consciously to define myself as a spiritual seeker, though I was looking for something that I really couldn't even name. The seeking stage culminated one ordinary day in a mind-bending, dramatic, life-changing, Abraham Maslow-worthy peak experience. It woke me up with the force of a lightning bolt, and I have never been able to return to my drowsy, fruit-juicy experience. It happened when a friend and I were playing around with guided imagery. He was the guide, and I had my eyes shut, and I imagined the images suggested. I'd never done this before, but yes, I can conjure up a mountaintop. Oh, yes, there's a little cabin at the top. It just appeared. Hey, wow, this is fun. Oh, yep, here comes a little wise old man. Ask him a question. Suddenly, from someplace far beyond my conscious mind, from someplace in my being to which I was a complete stranger, a question rose up and asked itself. Can you guess what it was? Who am I? It reverberated with such force that I could feel my molecules separate and my individuality begin to merge into the collective. And for the first time, I knew with experience both my own separate nature and the unity of all things. Then, at the edge of extinction, the roar in my head subsided. The molecules of my body collected themselves back into their familiar form, and I've been subsequently living ever after. The who am I question that burst open my awareness was one that people around me all at the time were asking all over the place. It was a question that I had actively scoffed at. The question seemed contrived and irrelevant. Well, I am who I am. Yet, after all my seeking after something that I could only name spiritual, whatever that is, I had found, as happens in spiritual quests, a sense of myself. The journey of the religious kid and the seeker of things spiritual did not lead to the doors of the church or the nunnery. It veered off into psychology as I pursued that glimmer of self-knowledge awakened on that imaginary mountaintop. Dimly aware at last of the sound of my own voice and the nature of my own truths, I realized that I'd been living my mother's life rather than my own. The marriage at 18, the four children. Over the next few years, this awareness led to a divorce and eventually to leaving Boise. I abandoned the role of spiritual seeker to follow the path of personal growth by going to California and graduate school to become a psychotherapist. Not that I knew what one was, really, or what one did. Here's what I knew about psychology at the time. As I was moving through the dark night of divorce, someone suggested to me that I might be depressed. And I didn't know what that meant. That was the days before all the psychopharmacology ads on TV. So I went home and looked it up in the dictionary. And the dictionary said depressed was pressed down upon. Yeah, I did feel kind of pressed down upon. I guess I was depressed. I know a little more now. I've spent the last 30 years learning about not just depression, but the amazing machinations and possibilities of the human psyche. I had a private practice in California for many years, and for the last 5 years, I have retired to work half-time as a counselor in an employee assistance program. Probably once a month, a client asks, "How can you sit here and listen to people's problems all day?" It is true that clients come to me with their problems, and often we problem solve. And clients ask for advice, and I give advice because I think the world would be so fine if it were run my way. But it's my real job and my privilege. My real job to be present to the very sacred process of people grappling with the deepest and most crucial issues in their lives. It's my job to witness courageous moments of healing and self-discovery in the midst of darkness and pain. It's my job to experience daily the wonder and inspiration in the potential and creativity of the human spirit. Enough of the time, my job is like sitting in a garden and watching roses bloom. I would like to share some experiences from that work that have led to a deeper understanding of concepts that for me had previously just been church words. It's from clients that I have learned a meaningful way to think about sin and grace and evil. I should have said sin and evil, and let's save grace for last. Theologian Paul Tillich suggests that the word sin should be used not to denote an act, something we do that is bad. That's how I always thought of it. That's why sin didn't concern me too much, because remember, I was a good girl. But Tillich suggests that sin is actually a state of being, the state of being separated from self, from others, from the ground of being, in Tillich's term, God. My client, Margie, was a living monument of separation. Incidentally, as I mention my clients' experiences to illustrate my own journey, be aware that I've changed the names and circumstances. When she came to see me for counseling, she was in her 30s. She was employed as an accountant, raising her 3 children. The details of her history came out slowly over the course of her 9-year therapy. I give them to you here in capsule form. She didn't know who her father was. When she was 3, her mother, whom she loved fiercely, either gave up Margie and her siblings or they were taken away by the welfare authorities. Eventually, Margie and her 5 brothers were placed in a foster home where she lived for the next 11 years until she left at age 16. To social services, the situation seemed ideal. Marjorie Jane, Margie, got to be with her siblings. She was clothed, well-fed. Whenever the placement came up for review, it was pointed out how well she's doing in school. What social services didn't see was that Margie was being physically and emotionally and sexually abused and used for the entire 11 years that she lived with this foster family, who claimed to care for her as they hurt her body, mind, and spirit. The way that she was able to survive the devastation that was her childhood was to pull her child self, Janie, as she was called then, into a tight little ball inside, hidden away where no one could touch, and to split off from consciousness those parts of herself that had suffered pain and shame and writhed with guilt and seethed with rage and yearned for love, creating separate parts of herself. In the therapy room, slowly, often painfully, over time, I got to know these separate parts of her psyche. A strong and fierce 12-year-old named Running Deer, who carried her anger and who protected her by running interference with the outside world. I knew Black Scars, Black Star, who carried her hate. And listen to this. Black Star and Running Deer never talked with each other, never met inside her psyche, because, as they explained to me, if hate and anger ever got together, then she would be just as bad as the foster parents. I knew Morning Star, who carried her love inside and who protected Janie and the fragments of child parts too wounded to survive alone. The psychological word for her path of survival is multiple personality disorder. I see in her survival, in the extraordinary organization of her psyche, an amazing illustration of human possibility. An astounding demonstration of the tenacity and creativity of the human spirit. Her therapy was a continually moving and spiritual experience for me. Margie lived an extreme experience of separation, a state of sin by Tillich's definition. But no way was she the sinner that her foster mother told her that she was. The foster mother told this little girl who wanted only to be loved that she was a sinner because she had her mother's blood, the blood of a whore, running in her veins. Surely we could only call this abominable piece of interaction by the word evil. Another word that took on meaning in working with Margie. My childhood was an innocuous experience in a household with loving parents. While I grew up in the 50s hearing about the evils of communism, evil was always an abstract concept, something to do with clearly bad people, none of which I knew. Margie's foster parents appeared to their community as good people, taking into their care a family of six children. Yet it is the following story from Margie's experience that let me grasp some of the real essence of the word evil on a cognitive and an emotional level. She was about 9 when she had the glorious experience of winning a lamb at the county fair. It was her lamb, and she loved it dearly, as you can imagine a little lonely girl abandoned by her mother would love a little lamb. She named it Baby, and she fed it and cared for it as it grew from a lamb to a sheep. One day, as she came down the road after being dropped off by the school bus, she saw that they were outside the barn butchering. Hanging from a hook was a carcass. You know, it was Baby. Margie, of course, was shocked and devastated. Whatever else evil might be, it is certainly that which fails to recognize the innocence and the frailty of a child's heart and deliberately or even thoughtlessly rips into it. Happily, Happily, it was also with Margie that I witnessed grace. I've always liked that word, and it comes easily, naturally, to my tongue. But it's Paul Tillich again who's offered clarity. Tillich speaks of grace as renewal of life with life. The reconciliation of self with itself. The acceptance of that which was rejected. Sometimes it happens, Tillich says, that we receive the power to say yes to ourselves. That peace enters us and makes us whole. That self-hate and self-contempt disappear and that our self is reunited with itself. Throughout her life in therapy, Margie struggled with pain, confusion, dark memories, fear, anger. She struggled with more intensity than most of us have to endure. But in the course of our journey together, there were many moments of grace, of accepting that which was rejected, of reconciliation of self with itself as she reclaimed split-off emotions and experiences to restore an integrated whole. Many who have a history like hers succumb to the damage. Where did she get such courage to move through horrific memories and agonizing feelings to come back to wholeness? It seems like grace to me. Incidentally, you should know that during the time we worked together, she enrolled in the local junior college and got her associate's degree. Then she went on to get her bachelor's degree. Then she went on to get her master's degree in social work. And she got a job working with troubled teenagers, which had been a lifelong dream of hers. Margie was the second client I had ever had in my life. Though I was pretty well trained, I was as green and raw as an intern could be. Grace was surely with me through the therapy as we bumbled along together toward the renewal of life with life. As I didn't have the skill or experience to take any credit for her remarkable journey of healing. She's still an inspiration to me personally and professionally as I recall the magnetism and the energy of a spirit driven to move beyond the damage of sin and evil to become her own healing force in the world. Of course, few therapies are as dramatic and intense as Margie's journey was. But the more daily issues confronted in the counseling room have offered me the same experience of spiritual enrichment as I sit with clients. With the woman burned out on life, who learns it's okay to say no rather than trying to be all things to all people. Sitting with the man facing retirement with depression, who finds new possibilities as he connects with forgotten aspects of his personality. The couple who commit to replacing their growing hostility with reconnection and love. I sit every day with everyday people brave enough to confront their demons or aware enough to reconnect with their essential selves or vulnerable enough to change behaviors that don't serve them well. Recently, I was sitting with a client who was agonizing, trying to come to grips with the experience of childhood molest by a family friend. Picture this with me. She's working in imagery, a potent way to integrate and heal memories and emotions that goes beyond the relief that just understanding can bring. She is sitting in her chair, eyes closed, imagining the young child that she was. She's reporting what she sees. I'm sitting in my chair a few feet away, her witness and grounding presence. She describes the child that she is imagining as disturbing to her somehow. She's repulsive, I know I should feel sorry for her, the client says, but I don't. She doesn't like me either. She reports that in the image, the child has no face. It's kind of disgusting. Doesn't want to talk to her. I tell her, just let her feel your heart. She's silent. Then, oh, she's smiling. She gives a gasp, realizing she has a face. Yeah, she's getting a face. She's a whole child now. She's leaning into me. I do like her. I am awestruck by the sense of a sacred moment as she spontaneously moves from self-loathing to reconciliation with the child that she was. In the next session, she reported that she'd not realized the deep disgust she'd carried for herself, and that throughout the week she felt different somehow, saw the world differently, and that she had uncharacteristically cut off a relationship with a man who really didn't treat her very well. Spirituality at work.